First case is Lottie v. West America Insurance Company. Mr. Grimes.
May it please the Court, my name is Douglas Grimes. I represent the plaintiff in this case. One of the first issues we wanted to assert is that it's our belief that the denial of the Birdsell claim was based on the vacancy clause exclusion for vandalism and malicious mischief. Our view is that no reasonable jury could have found that the Birdsell property became vacant on March 31, 2001. During the trial, West admitted that it did not know when the premises became vacant. It's our position that West arbitrarily decided that March 31, 2001 was the date the vacancy commenced in order for it to be able to deny the claim. In our opinion, this constituted bad faith. We were not allowed to argue bad faith with regard to that issue or any issue in this case. The date of the vacancy of the Birdsell property is central to the jury's verdict that West did not breach the Birdsell contract. We also believe that the court abused its discretion by rejecting Lottie's instruction pertaining to the interpretation of the vacancy exclusionary clause of the contract. Also, when the court itself withdrew its own proposed instruction related to the interpretation of an insurance policy provision. In this case, the West interpreted, after the claim had been filed, interpreted the vacancy clause to include arson fire within the terms of vandalism and malicious mischief. We believe that that was an error, and that the court, we should have had an instruction with regard to the interpretation of an ambiguous provision in the insurance contract. Fire was a specifically covered peril under the policy. And under our reading, it could have only been excluded, that is, fire could have only been excluded under the intentional loss provision of the policy. Our view is that there was not sufficient evidence to support a finding by a reasonable jury that Mr. Lottie caused, or that Mr. Lottie set or had anyone else to set the fires to his properties. We believe that there was no evidence that a reasonable jury could rely upon that Mr. Lottie intentionally set the fire or had someone to set the fire to his property. We must remember that the Birdsell claim, the denial, was based upon the vacancy of the property for 30 consecutive days. With regard to the Linden property, there was never a determination, one, of coverage, or no evidence that Mr. Lottie set the fire or caused anyone else to set the fire to his property. The Linden claim was never resolved. After 6 years, that claim was never resolved. We believe that the failure to resolve that claim was itself a breach of the insurance contract by West.
What do you mean it's never resolved?
I'm sorry?
You say it's never resolved.
Well, it was never resolved by the insurance company.
Where is it?
It's still in limbo, except to the extent that the jury found that West did not breach the Linden contract. So that contract, at one level, is in limbo.
Does that mean it's still pending?
Well, if we take the jury's verdict as it stands, the jury adjudicated that particular claim. But the insurance company never adjusted that claim. They never approved the claim, and they never denied the claim. We also believe that the court abused its discretion when it refused to admit the affidavit of Mr. Moore, whose testimony related to the question of when the property at Birdsall became vacant. Mr. Moore's affidavit was central to the jury finding that West did not breach the Birdsall contract. There were a number of conflicting dates as to when the property at Birdsall became vacant. The fire department placed it, I believe, in mid-April. William Lottie placed it in late April. I believe that Deborah Lottie placed it in late April, mid to late April. Mr. Moore's affidavit also placed it in, I believe it was mid-April. Mr. Moore lived next door to the Birdsall property. And if I'm not mistaken, he was the one that called the fire department when he saw smoke coming from the building. The court refused to admit Mr. Moore's affidavit because it felt that it was not any more probative than any of the other testimony in the case. Our position is that Mr. Moore did not suffer from any of the disabilities that any of the other parties may have suffered from because he was simply a neighbor. He had no interest in the property. He had no interest to defend, and our view is that he had no reason to lie. In addition to that, Mr. Moore's affidavit had been part of the submission in the partial summary judgment phase of the case, and his affidavit was never challenged. His deposition was never taken. And so our position is that the court should have allowed Mr. Moore's affidavit to be read to the jury. In this case, we were unable to argue bad faith as to the date that the Birdsall became vacant, as to the modification of the vacancy clause, which we consider the interpretation of vandalism and malicious mischief to have been. We could not argue that that was bad faith. We could not argue that bad faith was afoot because this policy was a fire policy. And the only aspect or fire that would be excluded would be one where Mr. Lottie intentionally set the fire or caused others to set the fire. And we believe that there was no evidence of that. Clearly, there is argument that there was circumstantial evidence. I reserve my time.
Thank you, Mr. Grimes. Mr. Haley?
Your Honors, Counsel, may it please the Court, good morning. On this first issue of whether there's sufficient evidence in the record to sustain the jury verdict on the defense of the application of the vandalism and malicious mischief clause for excluding coverage, we believe there is sufficient evidence in the record to support the jury verdict, and by that standard, the verdict should be affirmed. Probably the most significant evidence is the electric company records and the testimony of the representative of the electric company at the trial, and this is all outlined in our brief, Your Honors, that showed at the end of March, when the tenant was leaving the property when her federal subsidy housing ended, that the electric company was contacted and the service records were changed effective March 27th, which the power company testified is very common in a rental situation where either the tenant or the landlord would then take the electric bill out of the name of the tenant, put it back in the landlord, or turn the service off. And from March 27th through the readings in May, middle of May when this fire occurred, and beyond, the records show that the usage of power dropped off by some 90-95% or more. Hundreds of kilowatt hours are used during the months when people were living there, and after March 27th, for one period of time, 7 kilowatt hours was used. For the next monthly period, 8 kilowatt hours. So that probably is the most powerful evidence, establishes no one was living there. The company does not have to fix the exact date that the tenant moved out, as long as the property was vacant for more than 30 days. The fire occurred on May 16th. So when the adjuster began working on the loss, when it was initially assigned to him, the information that he collected from the insured himself, Mr. Lottie, reported to the adjuster that the tenant moved out on April 1st or 2nd. Mr. Lottie's sister-in-law, Deborah Lottie, who was one of the caretakers of the property or agents acting on Mr. Lottie's behalf in Indiana, taking care of the properties, worked with the housing authority and reported that the property was vacant in the second week of April. In fact, Mrs. Lottie went there to try to collect any holdover rent from the tenant, and she did not find the tenant at home. And Mrs. Lottie's testimony was that she never saw anybody living in the property after April 8th or 9th. William Lottie, her husband, the brother of Mr. R.D. Lottie, the plaintiff, who was also a caretaker of the property, did testify that he believed he saw the tenant there sometime in the last week of April. That was moving about inside the property. That was not testimony that he saw that she was living there. There was other evidence that she had already left and moved to another state. And at that point, if she was there, if you believe Mr. William Lottie, she may have been back collecting her belongings. The point is that there is sufficient evidence in which the jury could conclude that the property had been vacant for 30 days, and there's no challenge to the conclusion that arson was the cause of the fires. That was the only evidence that was presented in the district court. That issue was taken away from the jury, and Judge Lee found as a matter of law and instructed the jury that this was, in fact, an arson fire. So we think.
Were there any prosecutions arise out of this, these fires?
There were none that we know of, Your Honor. Whether there is or is not a criminal prosecution doesn't play.
Yeah, I'm just curious. Yeah.
Thank you, Your Honor. We think that this sustains the jury verdicts both on the exclusion clause for the Birdsell property, the first fire, and the evidence of arson and the facts and the record which show the connection between Mr. Lottie, his brother, and sister-in-law in Indiana are sufficient for the jury to conclude that one or both of them was acting on his behalf in setting the fire. William Lottie, in particular, had been present in two prior fires that Mr. Lottie had before the summer of this case, in both rental properties where insurance claims were made and money was paid to recover for rebuilding those properties. And in the summer of these fires in 2000, William Lottie was the caretaker for the property. He had keys to both properties. He admitted he was present in the Birdsell house on the day of the fire. He had taken gasoline there to do some painting and clean the brushes with gasoline. It was a latex-based paint, but he brought gasoline to clean the paint off the brushes. Both the special investigator for the insurance company and the arson investigator testified that you can't clean latex-based paint with gasoline. Both the South Bend Fire Department and the independent cause and origin investigator concluded that they were both arson fires. Mr. William Lottie would have been the person who would have had to have made the repairs. It would have cost Mr. R.D. Lottie money to have to get the properties in a sufficient condition to be approved for re-rental through the federal housing subsidy program. And all of these facts, Your Honor, support what Indiana calls the arson defense, the triangle of an intentional fire motive and opportunity to set that fire for insurance proceeds. So we believe this supports both the arson defense and the application of the vacancy exclusion clause. Mr. Moore's affidavit, I believe, was not improperly excluded by the district court under the abuse of discretion standard. It was not based on erroneous facts. It was not arbitrary. Mr. Moore himself came in and testified, and the court concluded that he did not have the mental capacity at this point to testify on his own. So then the question became whether his affidavit that was signed some 4 years before could be used. And the court ruled that it could not, that there was more probative testimony under the residual exception to the federal rules of evidence. There was more probative testimony from other eyewitnesses and indeed the parties and relatives of the parties to the case that it was not sufficiently trustworthy, the affidavit in and of itself, and that the issue was not timely raised and decided sufficient to be able to address it. In fact, if you consider the Moore affidavit itself, Your Honors, it does not even say that Mr. Moore saw the tenant living there inside the 30 days, the May 16th fire date, and you back that up 30 days. All it says is in mid to late April, I saw the tenant. She told me that they were going to move. Several weeks later, I saw a yellow moving van backed up to the front door of the house and contents being moved out of the house. That doesn't say when she was living there. There's no more firm dates than that. We believe the judge did not act arbitrarily, and there's sufficient basis in the record to exclude the Moore affidavit. The plaintiff was not prevented from presenting any evidence that he believed supported his breach of contract claim at trial. The bad faith and punitive damages and race discrimination claims had been removed from the trial because summary judgment was granted on those claims by the district judge. So the only thing for trial was the breach of contract claims. There was no evidence that was offered by the plaintiff on his breach of contract claims that was excluded. So there's simply no support for plaintiff's argument that they were prevented from introducing some type of evidence on the bad faith claim at this trial. Well, that count was never a part of this trial. Whether that evidence overlapped and whether it also supported their breach of contract claims, they were allowed to present all of that evidence. And the jury found against them on those claims, whether you say the plaintiff failed to prove his breach of contract claims in and of themselves, or whether we say that we proved the arson defense and or the exclusion clause on the Birdsell Street property, the verdicts were against the plaintiff and for the defendant on both properties, and there's a sufficient basis in the record to support that. There was no attempt to reopen.
Thank you, Mr. Hale. That's fine. Mr. Grimes, do you have anything further?
Yes. First of all, I don't believe that I said that we were prevented from presenting evidence of bad faith because it did overlap. It was intertwined. What I said, what I intended to say was that we were prevented from arguing bad faith in each of these instances, starting with the determination of the date of the vacancy occurred. The fact that the water company records would show that it won, it changed over the records, that there was a reduction, that does not mean that the property was vacant. And as a result, we don't believe that the water company records, and as was testified at trial, the witness testified that they don't know whether the property was vacant at that time or not. Mr. Moore said that he saw property being removed. So the premises could have been occupied.
It could have been, but, you know, it's a jury issue.
Sure.
Evidence.
Yes, I do understand that, Judge. I guess I was just trying to deal with that argument. With regard to Mr. William Lottie, he lived in South Bend. So the fact that he lived near these properties, that does not mean, or I don't believe it's even certain.
You have a curious propensity to being at the site of fires.
Well, he was not at the sites. There's no evidence that he was at the sites.
Yeah, the previous fires, right? We're cleaning the brushes with the gasoline and so on.
Well, there was not the previous. That was the Birdsell property where that occurred. And that's
why is he cleaning the brushes with the gasoline?
Because the water was shut off at the Birdsell property when he was there repainting the property.
So where did he get the gasoline?
Mr. Lottie was a painter. He was a professional painter. He had brought all of his equipment over that morning.
Why had he brought gasoline with him?
To clean the brushes, because the water was cut off, which you know.
Why did he bring water with him to clean the brushes?
Well, Judge, he could have done that, but he didn't bring a container of water.
He brought a container of gasoline. Well,
he brought a half.
A jury can say, well, that's pretty suspicious.
Well, I'm not going to argue that that's out there, but what we're saying, I've concluded. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Grime, Mr. Haley.